Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Zizi Packer. Her first book has just come out. It's a book of short stories called Drinking Coffee Elsewhere. It was published by Riverhead Books. Her stories have been making a stir for quite a few years, actually. There was a story that won a Best American Stories, chosen by E.L. Doctorow, which begins this book, a story called Brownies. She appeared in one of the debut fiction issues of The New Yorker. And so this collection has been widely anticipated. I didn't know until I sat down to read it how fresh and original and really precise the voice would be in it. It's a really fresh and enjoyable voice. You've been writing since you were what age?
It's sort of odd to say, because I could start and say, oh, since I was, you know, 7 or 8, or I could sort of say that I started to actually look at writing when I was in high school, and I had this English teacher called Mrs. K. Torionis, and she encouraged us to actually write stories as opposed to just read the stories and critique them and then hand in your sort of book report or your paper on them. And so I guess since then is when I really became aware of what I had been doing as actually writing and something more than just this sort of cathartic thing I used to do as a kid.
And how old were you when your first story was published? I think it was in 17 magazine.
Yeah, I'm thinking that I was 19 or something around about that
That's not in this book, though.
No, no.
It's interesting to me because when I was reading, I thought one of the great virtues of this collection is that you don't seem to have any indecisiveness about how to talk about these subjects that people have even lost the ability to use direct language about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I'm talking to a writer, I don't know now whether to say African-American, mm-hmm. whether to say girl, can I say girl? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it seems as if you made a lot of decisions that are likely upsetting to everyone.
Yeah, yeah, I knew that when I started, I think Brownies was the first story where I kind of became aware that, you know, this is a story that maybe a lot, not everyone would like or appreciate, you know, could say, well, these girls seem very mean and, you know, the girls in the Brownie troop. But then I decided when I was writing it that I couldn't necessarily be, I mean, I could be aware of what I was writing in the sense of its sort of social and political context, but I should not be aware of the audience for that, not in the writing of the story. And I just felt as though if I were aware of that audience and what they might say and how they might criticize this decision or that decision, that I wasn't going to be able to write as truly as I wanted mm-hmm. to write. So I kind of went through a period in which I sort of beat myself up about it, because it's so hard. You sort of realize, well, what will my mother say about this, or what will, you know, some of my friends at the African American house at Yale say about this, you know. And I just had to eventually come to a point where I had to be just true to myself and the story that I wanted to tell, and not necessarily worry about the sort of repercussions of what others might think.
Well, I think that the first story, Brownies, I to be honest, I can't imagine anyone not liking it. I think it is already a classic American story, and it's shocking.
Oh, thank you.
These girls have gone to summer brownie camp. They're accompanied, it's not just brownies, it's kind of church brownies.
Mm-hmm,
it's,
mm-hmm.
And they're accompanied in some cases by parents and church ladies. And there are other brownie troops around, including one very blonde and strawberry and vanilla white girls group. And the girls decide that they're going to kick their asses and they claim that they've been called names. Mm-hmm. Names that, you know, I suspect would still be offensive on the radio.
Yeah.
And they're going to kick their ass and the confrontation is going to be in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And we get to the story and we realize that the other troop is retarded.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, wow, you know, mm-hmm. how is this going to play out?
Yeah.
These tough black girls, retarded girls, the troop leader, their troop leader says, these girls do not speak this way. If you've heard this word,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
it is because some of them have echolalia and we can't answer for their parents.
Yeah.
And there's a like moral crisis and cultural crisis. And the story, in fact, doesn't stop springing its surprises there. I mean, was that a turning point story for you?
Yeah, it really was. Because I knew that I had to write about these girls, and I kind of actually felt sort of scared in doing it because I was thinking, oh, you know, the trap of writing about, you know, younger, you know, children and having this might be just sort of a story that I have to get out of my way to write other things. But when at one point I began to realize when they're going to encounter these girls, and these girls are not going to be the way they think the girls are going to be. And I think it's very good and interesting you said, like, here are these tough black girls, because I think that's how they themselves also want to, you know, perceive themselves, when really they have some of the same. They're sort of vulnerable as well, and they're sort of caught in this sort of vicious cycle. And I knew that when they encountered these girls, they were going to react in this way. Or it became, I began to know that they were going to react in this way that was going to kind of reveal, you know, what they had been taught and indoctrinated with. And even though they did not know that these girls were retarded, that they feel so they have, that they've been, that they feel aggrieved, and so that they had to act out in that way. And so when they actually find out what happens with them, they sort of pull back a little bit, but, you know, one of them just, you know, just really can't. And it seemed to me this way, and I wasn't, as I was writing it, I wasn't thinking, oh, I want to have this clash of cultures and morals and this and that. But I realized as I was writing it that, okay, this much bigger thing is going on than just, you know, what I've been trying to write about these girls. And I kind of let it play itself out the way I thought it would play out.
Well, you're very funny.
Oh. I think that's something that I end up having to do just because I just, you know, I think there usually is this sort of intersection between, you know, the humor is always running along concurrently with sort of tragedy.
I'm talking to Zizi Packer, the author of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, a first collection of stories that has real vigor, real life. And I found myself thinking, why is it? Do you have an idea? These do seem to me to be very different from a lot of African American stories.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as if other writers are often ashamed of using the street culture
mm-hmm.
that is implicit. I felt these things were so fresh. I you know, they read so fluidly. I mean, you know, it's like falling off a log. You just say, oh, I love this writing. And I think of how much writers have taken on a more austere kind of diction,
yeah.
Toni Morrison, say, Alice Walker, out of, you know, a need to say, see, I'm literary. Mm-hmm. I speak the language of literature.
Yeah. Toni Morrison's one of my favorite writers. But I do think that the style is sort of different. I mean, I think there seems to be this way in which, you know, it's very understandable, in which, you know, the culture, African-American culture, has been sort of appropriated by, you know, sort of larger society. And so in a way that can be sort of, you know, almost deemed sort of buffoonish if you sort of show this character that's on the street or this you know, church lady and how completely wrapped up in the church culture she is. And I think that people, a lot of black writers, maybe somewhat afraid, understandably so, that if they write this way, that the writing will seem stereotypical. The writing will seem to make fun of or to mock African-American culture. But I kind of, I'm a longtime fan of Zora Neale Hurston, and one of the things she did was she went around, she drove to as many places as she could, and of course she had this, benefactress, who enabled her to do some of this. But she was just in love with the language of black people, and she got a lot of flack from people like Richard Wright and the whole sort of movement during the Harlem Renaissance, who just sort of thought that, this was kind of portraying African American language in the way that sort of minstrel, shows had, and the way that whites had when making fun of blacks. But she saw the beauty of it, and I dare I compare myself with her, but I do too. I mean, I love when you hear just different ways in which people talk. I mean, and none of them are exactly the same. I mean, you can go on one street corner and you'll have people talking in completely different ways. But yet there's this sort of beauty and poetry in it, which if I didn't try to bring to my fiction, I would just feel I wasn't being true to myself.
I'm speaking to Cece Packer. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. Her book of stories, Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, was recently published by Riverhead Books. Now, I could be wrong, but I sensed an influence from Flannery O'Connor here.
Yeah, I love... it's strange because I haven't read any of her work recently, being like the last year or so. But, when I first started writing fiction, when I first started thinking I could really actually write a story, I somehow came upon in an anthology one of her most anthologized stories, A Good Man is Hard to Find. And I just love that story, and I couldn't, the way in which she was able to, show this sort of tragedy, but also have this sort of humor, humor running underneath it, and for it to be this sort of, very sort of Southern Gothic story. But I didn't even have the terms for that yet. But reading that, I began to read just everything that she had written because I was so fascinated by her. I could understand how some of that has possibly seeped through.
What struck me in particular was, as I was reading some of the people who've been writing about the books, they suggest that the stories are sort of irreligious, and it struck me that no, like Flannery O'Connor, this is objecting to the forms in which conventional religions shape themselves, their hierarchies and their social strata. But in fact, these stories have a spiritual core that they don't seem to reject at all.
Yeah, I kind of, one of the aspects of the sort of the church, as I might call it, is that I kind of object to is that here there's this, there's this real sort of feeling that people actually feel, but it gets sort of sublimated, is possibly the wrong word, but it gets sort of channeled into sort of doing the work of maintaining the structure of whatever the church is. And so in that way, a lot of churches tend to form themselves like governments, and maybe that has to do with just the intersection between government and church and state for a long time before you had the idea of the sort of state or nation state that's not going to abide by that. But it's sort of what it seems to do is to sort of actually take the sort of spirit out of the person in some ways, And I kind of just objected to that. And I think I rebelled against that in my own life. And I can see in these characters when they're going through this extremely hard time that they need something that's going to keep them going. And I think that they begin to also at some point rebel against that kind of, structure that takes what they feel that's actually real, and to try to channel it into something that's going to sort of continue this sort of edifice of the church itself.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense?
Well, no, I get it, because I just imagined you laughing When writing that sermon, the minister holds up a telephone, a princess phone that he's borrowed from a member of his congregation, the choir leader, and asks how many in the congregation have call waiting, and asks them if they're keeping Jesus on hold.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of astonishingly funny. Uh-huh. And even the choir leader finds herself laughing without being able to control herself. There is a quality here that the stories cause the characters to bump up against things they know every day and have to figure out a way not to laugh or how to laugh permissibly, which is what the stories seem to be about.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that story in particular, the one you're talking about, Every Tongue Shall Confess, it was a hard one to write and then a hard one to rewrite, because at one point I kept thinking, like, you know, so much of myself was going to the story that I was sort of writing it kind of laughingly, you know, and I wasn't necessarily giving credence to, okay, here's this character who actually does take this seriously. You know, she takes the church seriously, and she takes her beliefs seriously, even though she finds that, you know, every day she's coming up more and more against how the church differs from her actually belief, her belief of God. Or in God. And then I had to sort of, I ended up revising that story a number of times before I could sort of find what I hope is this sort of medium between, you know, here's the sort of humor of the situation, but here's this person who is sort of not able to take it, you know, sort of humorously, or is it only beginning to find out how she can. And that took a long time to do, just because I just, you know, I myself kind of had to look and see, well, what are my feelings on this, and how would I feel if I were Sister Clarice, and how would I, you know, how can I present her in the sense that she is this character, but she, you can sort of see under the character and around the character, but not necessarily through her.
One of the things that I like most, I'm afraid, I know that at The New Yorker they don't tend to like stories about people who are going to grow up to be writers.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I like best about this book is the feeling that for the narrator of these stories, there's nothing more important than reading and writing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's that solitary outsider feel that's compounded by other kinds of outsiderness. And you know, it's really interesting. It's almost as if the first state of being an outsider is someone who loves to imagine stories. And one of them at Yale says to the psychiatrist she's been forced to see, when she says that if she could be an inanimate object, the inanimate object she would choose is a revolver, he accuses her of constantly lying. And she says, you know, if I've been able to survive all this and get here, it's because I'm able to lie. I can pretend. And it seems to be, you know, the saving grace.
Yeah, I kind of think that with those characters, that it ends up being this sort of very nascent state that, you know, that yes, you could sort of see that they probably will become writers or something like that. But that they're not yet, you know, so self-conscious, and they also don't come from the backgrounds that was sort of even put in their heads that this is this possibility. I mean, you kind of have to have if you come from a background in which that kind of thing is stressed, it was like, oh yeah, you can be a writer, then that would sort of be this possibility for them. I think, you know, Dina at that point doesn't even sort of you know, yet, I have a feeling she probably will become but I don't think that she even sort of is aware enough of the sort of almost the luxury of, you know, being a writer, or that she could become a writer. So I think that's also another reason why, you know, on the one hand they sort of address like the possibility of the sort of the writing life without actually being, you know, overtly about the writing life the way some stories can be.
Self-conscious.
Yeah.
Stories. Yeah. But absolutely, because it gave me, you know, my first identification in these stories was with the narrator of Brownies, who, you know, has her book with her.
Yeah.
And, you know, they won't call her by her name. They call her Snot because she once sneezed on someone, and they regard that as the most exciting thing she's ever done.
Yeah, yeah.
This is unbearable for her. But it's a name of, I think, real affection for them. It was like her great act of... So I feel like I know her, and I know the way people don't want you to be Laura. They want you to be Snot, you know?
Yeah,
they want you to join in whatever raffishness they're proposing. And there she is, you know, the observing one, the solitary one. Were you that observer?
It's sort of strange because I kind of, in some ways, you know, I think of myself as being very observant. In some ways, I think, oh, that just went completely past me. I mean, I'm very sensitive to some aspects of the world, and you know, just surprisingly, sort of, not insensitive to others. But I do think that when I was a kid, the difference is that my mother actually really, she also loved reading, and so she was the one that she would talk about how when she was growing up, no one, you know, really paid attention to it or cared. I mean, her mother saw education as this way of getting a better, having a better life, and not necessarily sort of the enrichment in which, you know, my mother saw it, but everyone else around her. I mean, you know, my grandfather came up in the day of which, you know, reading was not considered, reading would get you nowhere. I mean, you had to, you know, get a job very soon. And so she actually encouraged us to read. But I think in doing so, when we did read a lot and went to the library nearly every day, you know, I saw that I would be sometimes ostracized by, you know, kids just because, you know, I wasn't really interacting with them. And so in a way, yeah, I think of myself a lot like, you know, sort of Laurel. But yeah, it does force you to become, you know, extremely observant because you're getting sort of you're getting information from two different sources, from the world and from this from what you're reading and from the text. So yeah, I do think that I've
now some of the characters have been prepared because they've been bright when young and they've been sent to prep school, mm-hmm. and they arrive at Yale, as you say, with the most elastic faces imaginable.
Yeah.
In other words, they can look however they expect that they want people to see them or how they expect people want them to look. What's impressive here is that these narrators... they haven't been prepared. They've been propelled into a world that is not their own, mm-hmm. and is foreign to them and is full of a kind of culture shock that they can't anticipate. But they don't back down. They don't develop smiling manners, mm-hmm. or imitative protective mimicry.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem very fiercely themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've been both. I mean, in some way I've had to kind of, you know, it was a sort of culture shock to go from, you know, this very sort of southern, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, to, you know, sort of eastern sort of prep school where everyone kind of, or not even prep, even going to prep schools for the summer. Like, I went to this one, you know, math and science program, and, you know, it was the first time I had a bagel, it was the first time I had tea with milk, and I mean, all these kinds of things that were just so shocking, which, I mean, they seem very superficial, but then also just people being able to sort of have access to this sort of life that, you know, there was this just a single building for this library, which I'd never seen any sort of high school or whatever, prep school, you know. I'd never seen a high school that had just a completely separate building for a library, which I thought was just amazing that these kids had access to. So in a way, I similar to Dina and Spurgeon, some of the other characters experienced this severe culture shock. But in a way, I think also, you know, I've had to realize that in some ways I have changed too. I mean, I've had to sort of realize that, oh, you can't necessarily register your shock all the time at how different this place is or how different the world is for some people than it is for others. And you do almost have to, or at least I guess I have, put on the sort of way in which you're, you know, you present yourself to the world, but yet you're thinking behind this kind of mask. But what I love about the characters is that they would be sort of this unvarnished version of that. You know, they, you know, it for many of them, it hasn't even occurred to them that, oh, they can sort of almost see more if they
all right.
Yeah, exactly. Or do the sort of imitative mimicry that you're referring to. So,
well, they're very forward, and it's almost as if the great virtue of them is that they, at least in their presentation, they don't seem to have a choice about being themselves. And that seems to me also to be what makes Drinking Coffee Elsewhere such a remarkable book, because it doesn't, you know, it seems like from very early on, the possibility of toning things down, or you just said,
Yeah, they can't. And I think that's, there are so many people who are in that position, but the difference is with them, if they haven't even had the kind of, if they haven't even been armed with, you know, the sort of education that some of these characters have had, the sort of self-education of reading, that then they get caught in these positions that, you know, some members of my family or friends of mine are in, which is that, you know, here they are in this situation, some of them in the inner cities or whatever, and so they're in the position where they can't back down, but yet they're not even armed with the kind of I don't want to say reading as a sort of device, but they're not armed with any kind of other mode of escape or entree into the world, which reading and education obviously provide. So,
I've been speaking to Zizi Packer, author most recently of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, published by Riverhead Books. It's a first collection of short stories and a really fresh and vibrant voice. Thank you, Zizi, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Had a good time.
It was great.
You can read the first story of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.